14, we'll be reading from the Revised Standard Version for most of the week, and we will see where the theme comes from for our series this week. 2 Kings chapter 13 relates to the reign of Joash, the son of Ahaziah, king of Judah. We read in verse 14, "Now when Elisha had fallen sick with the illness of which he was to die, Joash, king of Israel, went down to him and wept before him, crying, 'My father, the chariot of Israel and its horsemen.' So Elisha was regarded by Joash as being the chariot in the nation of Israel. Indeed, if we go back in the king's account to chapter 2, we see that the reference to chariots and horsemen does not only occur there. In 2 Kings chapter 2, we have the well-known account of Elijah and Elisha. In this account, of course, Elijah is taken up into heaven by a whirlwind. And in verse 12, "And Elisha saw it and cried, my father, the chariotry of Israel and its horsemen.' Because in the nation of Israel, Elijah was the chariot of Yahweh." Now, chariots introduce themselves so frequently in the scripture that we may miss these incidental references, especially in an age where today chariots are not particularly well known, especially by us in Canada. But for those who are students of the Old Testament, the use of the word chariot is very impressive indeed. I'm going to quote you just a small section from Nahum, and it reads as follows. "The shield of his mighty man is red," speaking of the Persians, "his soldiers are clothed in scarlet, and the chariots flash like flame when mustered in array. The chargers prance, and the chariots rage in the streets. They rush to and fro through the squares, and they gleam like torches. They dart like lightning." So when the prophet Nahum gave his message to the children of Israel, there is a great vividness in the depiction of chariots. They often struck fear into the very heart of the Israelite, because for a long time the children of Israel did not have chariots of iron. But a chariot in the sense in which we are using the term chariot has quite a different meaning. It's really a vehicle of divine manifestation. For example, it speaks of the chariot of the cherubim in the Chronicles account. The chariot being a vehicle of divine manifestation. And as we know, there are God's angelic Elohim, those ministers of his that do his pleasure, the watchers of Daniel, the eyes of the Lord. These are the great chariots of the Almighty. But in another sense, when a man becomes a vehicle of divine manifestation, he is a chariot. "And the kingdom age we shall be made like unto the angels to die no more." And so we see the joining of the two families, God's great Abrahamic Elohim being joined to the angelic Elohim in the kingdom age. So our theme this week relates to the chariots of Israel. And we're going to look this week, God willing, at impressive figures in God's divine honor roll of great men whose life lessons we can learn and apply today. And one of the figures we tend to look at now is the figure Samson. Now, brothers and sisters, we are introduced early in the book of Genesis to a very important concept which will underline virtually everything we have to say this week. Scripture employs many figures of speech in conveying the basic ideas of the atonement. As we know, metonymy is used in many places in Scripture, where God says that he made him to be sin, who knew no sin. The figure of metonymy is applied, as many of our Christadelphian writers have pointed out. But the figure of personification is particularly vivid as it relates to the concept of sin and as it relates to the devil. And early in the Genesis account, we have God speaking to Cain. I'd like us to look at this passage.
because it shows us what sin is and how it must be handled. Genesis chapter 4 and verse 7. The Lord said to Cain, "Why are you angry, and why has your countenance fallen? If you do well, will you not be accepted? And if you do not do well, sin is couching at the door. Its desire is for you, but you must master it." Now notice the difference between the Authorized Version and the Revised Standard Version that seems to have the support of both translations. The language of personification. Sin is depicted as a lion or an animal couching at the door. And that's the usual word meaning to couch as a wild animal. It's the Hebrew word ravax, used in Genesis 49:9 for an animal. The person is depicted as being at a door. Sin is lying at the door. It's couching as a lion. And as you go, you must be aware of the couching lion, because if you are not aware of it, its desire is for you. And the word desire there, interestingly enough, is the word used for the relationship of Adam and Eve. So there's a close affinity between sin and the person. And the language of personification, sin is depicted as an animal couching there, waiting for you, and you must master it, because its desire is for you. Language could hardly be more vivid as to what the real enemy of mankind is, early in Genesis chapter 4 and verse 7. "And we shall see in the chariots of Yahweh," or the Almighty, "many times how divine strength is made perfect in human weakness. And we'll see how men who had great virtues of character fell because they're unable to master sin." And the figure we're going to look at this morning is Samson. And we shall begin this morning by looking at the judge's account. The period of the judges is characterized as a time when every man did what was right in his own eyes. It was a time, brothers and sisters, when compromise was virtually the order of the day. We read, for example, in Judges chapter 1, verse 18, the character of the day. "Judah also took Gaza with its territory, and Ashkelon with its territory, Ekron with its territory. And the Lord was with Judah, and he took possession of the hill country, but he could not drive out the inhabitants of the plain, because they had chariots of iron." Joshua had gone through the land and had virtually conquered the land of the Amorites. It remained for the mop-up action, so to speak, of the people to go in and to take their inheritance. But look what happened in Judges chapter 1. It tells us in verse 27, the Canaanites persisted in dwelling in that land. "And when Israel grew strong, they put the Canaanites to forced labor, but did not utterly drive them out." And the failure through compromise was a failure to take the words of divine revelation seriously. God had told them to utterly exterminate and to drive out the people of the land. But they didn't do this. In chapter 2, verse 13, they forsook the Lord and served the Baals and the Ashtaroth. "So the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel, and he gave them over to plunderers who plundered them. And he sold them into the power of their enemies round about, so that they could no longer withstand their enemies. Whenever they marched out, the hand of the Lord was against them for evil, as the Lord had warned, and as the Lord had sworn to them, and they were in sore straits. Then the Lord raised up judges who saved them out of the power of those who plundered them." So here's the pattern of the nation of Israel. A very explicit command. The basic backbone of opposition had been broken by Joshua. It was merely the time for the nation of Israel to go in and take possession of the land. But they compromised the divine instruction. As you can see, the Canaanites persist in dwelling in the land. Well, why did the Canaanites persist in dwelling in the land? Because we are told that they put the Canaanites to forced labor. Now you can imagine what an attractive alternative this would be to a basically agricultural society. Why bother doing the hard manual labor? Why not use these people of the land to be hewers of wood and drawers of water? And so they compromised in what would seem to be a very small area, putting the people to forced labor. As a result, the Canaanites persisted in the land. Verse 30, Zebulun, chapter 1, did not drive out the inhabitants of Kitron or the inhabitants of Nahalol, but the Canaanites dwelt among them and became subject to forced labor. But you know, it wasn't long until there was a further problem. Verse 32. But the Asherites dwelt among the Canaanites, the inhabitants of the land, for they did not drive them out. So you move from a position with Israel dominant, the Canaanites doing forced labor, until you come to the Asherites, and the Asherites are only dwelling among the Canaanites. The final decline, verse 34. The Amorites pressed the Danites back into the hill country, for they did not allow them to come down to the plain. And the Amorites persisted in dwelling, and it names there the places where they dwelt. So you can see the sequence of the compromise. A dominant power that compromised the express instruction of the Almighty, and they used these people for forced labor. They found out that after a while they were only dwelling with the people, as the Asherites did, until finally the Amorites became dominant, and they pressed the Danites back into the hill countries. They oppressed them and did not allow them to come down to the fertile plains. And that, brothers and sisters, opens for us the period of the judges when we have a man from the tribe of Dan, Samson, the strong man of Israel. But it was a difficult period in Israel's history. And all the way through the period of the judges, brothers and sisters, we have a repetition. We have a repetition of Israel's sin, then we have a period of their supplication, and then we have a period of their deliverance. Look, for example, in chapter 3, verse 8. Therefore the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel, and he sold them into the hand of Cushan-Rishathaim, king of Mesopotamia. And the people of Israel served Cushan-Rishathaim 8 years. And when the people of Israel cried to the Lord raised up a deliverer for the people of Israel to deliver them, Othniel, the son of Kenaz, Caleb's younger brother. They had to sin because they compromised divine instruction. When they sinned, they were oppressed by the people of the land. They cried to the Lord in supplication. The Lord provided deliverance. And that pattern is repeated in virtually all the period of the judges. Sin, oppression, then you have the suffering, and the final deliverance by the Almighty. And lest the nation of Israel should boast in how, in fact, deliverance would come, time and again, the Almighty delivered the nation through what we might call small and insignificant things. Look at chapter 4, in a period when there wasn't a man to stand on behalf of the nation. And God used a woman to deliver the nation. In verse 7, it tells you there, I will give him into your hand. The latter part of verse 9, for the Lord will sell Sisera into the hand of a woman. And so here, the nation of Israel was going to be delivered by this mother in Israel, a woman. And furthermore, we can see this happening all the way through the period of the judges. God delivers them by Ehud, a left-handed man, who in the account of the margin was lame in his right hand. A left-handed man. Or Shamgar and an ox goat, a tent peg, a pitcher, All of these kind of weak and insignificant things occur so frequently in the period of Judges that we can hardly miss the point. God's strength is being made perfect in human weakness, and the deliverance is not through the great legs of a man or the strength of a horse. It's by the divine provision. And brothers and sisters, that's why the nation of Israel was expressly forbidden. They were not to multiply horses, nor were they to go to Egypt for help. Woe to those who go down to Egypt for help and rely on horses, but do not look to the Holy One of Israel. And that's why King David in his conquest would hamstring the chariot horses. They were not to rest on the strength of man. They were to rest on the unseen chariots of the Almighty, his angels, and the great leaders in the nation who were vehicles of divine manifestation. And Samson was one man who comes in the narrative, the strong man of Israel, to deliver this beleaguered tribe of Dan and the nation. As we come to the book of Judges, and look specifically at the life of Samson, we will see how the Almighty worked in his life to achieve the end. So we'll turn now specifically to Judges chapter 13. Here's the pattern repeating. Verse 1. And the people of Israel again did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord gave them into the hand of the Philistines for 40 years. So there's the pattern. Sin and then suffering. This time at the hands of the Philistines. Well, you read in the account of Judges that in fact these principal cities of the Philistines were conquered. And Judah took Gaza with his territory, Ashkelon with his territory, Ekron with his territory. But the Philistines persisted in dwelling in the land, as did the other people, because of the failure of the nation to take the Almighty precisely in what he said. And so the principal work of this man of Israel, this judge, is in the tribe of Dan up here right next to Judah. It has to do with these cities that were once conquered, Gaza, Ashkelon, the principal cities of the Philistines. We're introduced to this man. He's a man of Zorah, of the tribe of the Danites. The second largest tribe when it entered the land, unable to conquer its inheritance that the Almighty had given to the tribe. And they went away up north into an area that God did not give them. And there they conquered the sleepy Sidonians, a people that were dwelling securely, and very shortly lapsed into idolatry. The tribe of Dan, not a very distinguished tribe in the nation. And yet it was from this tribe that this great man, Samson, would come. And we read his beginning in verse 4. This is the angel who appears to Manoah's wife. Therefore, beware. And drink no wine or strong drink, and eat nothing unclean. For lo, ye shall conceive and bear a son, and no razor shall come upon his head. For the boy shall be a Nazarite to God from birth, and he shall begin to deliver Israel from the hand of the Philistines. My brothers and sisters, his great mission in life was only to begin to deliver the nation from the hand of the Philistines. As we know, the Philistines continue to inhabit the maritime plain down here. They came from Caphtor Creek and settled this very fertile area here. They existed at the time of David, right after the time of Hezekiah. So he was only to begin to deliver the nation from this oppressive power. And the Philistines were a particularly uncouth people. They were a people like the grovelers in the dust. They were very warlike, very fierce when it came to fight. They had their gods, the Baals and the Ashtoreth and so on that we find referred to in Scripture, but nothing like the sophisticated religious worship that infiltrated from the north, from Tyre, from the Phoenicians, through Jezebel. So the nation of the Philistines is a particularly troublesome power, like thorns in the eyes and in the flesh of the nation of Israel. They had their gods, but they did not conquer the nation anything like the influence of Jezebel in the north some years later. So God begins to deliver Phoenician to a boy that was to be born, and he was to be a Nazarite from birth. A sanctified, set apart, and dedicated person for the work he has to do. Now, we don't have time to pursue all of the introduction to Samson's life, except to note verse 25 of chapter 13. Now here, brothers and sisters, it tells us that Samson, whose name means strength or son, depending which authority you use, the boy grew, the Lord blessed him, and the Spirit of the Lord began to stir him in Nathan Dan between Zorah and Eshtaol. So this is the place in the country that we're looking at where Samson grew, between Eshtaol and Zorah. And this is high country through here. And they could overlook the beautiful Sorek Valley, a name that related to the choicest of the vineyards that grew in this part of the country. I always have a feeling for Eshtaol, because the Shelburne area we come from is high plateau area, about the same elevation, about 1,200, 700 feet above sea level. And this is where Samson begins his deliverance. But alas, we read, Samson went down to Timnah, and at Timnah he saw one of the daughters of the Philistines. Now here's a man who's a Nazarite, by special vows set aside to be dedicated and separated to the service of his God. And the first thing we read in the introduction to his life is that he went down to Timnah. And there he saw one of the daughters of the Philistines. And he came up and told his father and mother, I saw one of the daughters of the Philistines at Timnah. Now get it for me as my wife. This must have been indeed a very tragic announcement to his father and his mother. I'm sure those of you who have children of a marriageable age will be very sympathetic to the words that we see. In the Genesis account, we have the attitude of godly men and women to this problem. In Genesis 26:34, we have the account there of Isaac and Rebekah. When Esau was 40 years old, he took to wife Judith, the daughter of Beeri the Hittite, and Basemath, the daughter of Elon the Hittite, and they made life bitter for Isaac and Rebekah. They were a grief of mind, is the way the narrative reads. The attitude of Rebekah is expressive. Rebekah said to Isaac, I am weary of my life because of the Hittite women. If Jacob marries one of the Hittite women, such as these, one of the women of the land, what good will my life be to me? Now, brothers and sisters, that's the attitude of the separation that was part of the outlook of the godly woman in Israel. Of what profit is it for us to bring into the world sons and daughters to have them go and marry the alien? They make life bitter, a grief of mind. And yet, brothers and sisters, we can do much in our life to prevent that happening when the child reaches the teenage period. As the psalmist said, may our sons be as full-grown plants or as saplings, straight and strong. And may our daughters be polished after the similitude of a palace. And that polishing and that training of a sapling doesn't, of course, begin when the child's in the teenage period. It begins as early as that child is malleable to the influence of a godly mother and father in the household. And there we have the idea of Rebekah. What good shall my life do me if Isaac marries one of these daughters of the land? And that's one of the reasons why our great heritage in the truth has remained intact for over 130 years is because of the Christadelphian insistence on godly standards in matters such as these. And yet here we have a man with such a great heritage that from birth he's a Nazarite, that his mother was almost to partake of the Nazarite vow in the matter of his birth. And yet what happens? As soon as he gets old enough to begin his itinerant work, he goes down to Timnah, not to this Philistine stronghold to deliver the nation from bondage. He goes down there because he saw one of the daughters of the Philistines. And you cannot but be impressed with here the emphasis upon what he saw. He saw one of the daughters of the Philistines. Verse 3, his father and his mother said to him, "Is there not a woman among the daughters of your kinsmen or among all our people that you must go to take a wife from the uncircumcised Philistine?" A particularly disparaging word. But Samson said to his father, "Get her for me, for she pleases me well," or in the Hebrew, "she is right in my own eyes." Now, brothers and sisters, this will be Samson's weakness as the narrative unfolds. And indeed, it is better for a person to rule his spirit than to take a city. And we shall see this as the life of Samson opens up. But here's the indication. He sees a daughter of the Philistines. And that's emphasized twice for us in the two verses. And then he replies to his dad and his mom when they plead with him, "What about all the daughters of the Israelites? Why do you have to go to an uncircumcised Philistine for a wife?" And he insists, "She's right in my own eyes." Now the narrative continues. His father and mother did not know that it was from the Lord, for he was seeking an occasion or an opportunity against the Philistines. At that time, the Philistines had dominion over Israel. Now, brothers and sisters, let's get one thing straight. When it says that it was from the Lord, it is not saying that the Lord made Samson do what he did. God has divine foreknowledge of the way men will exercise their free will. And we see this in the period of the Judges. From the point of view of the nation of Israel compromised divine instruction and let the Philistines persist in dwelling in the land. They wanted to use the Canaanites for forced labor. From the divine point of view, reading the account of the Judges and in the Psalms, it was God who left the nations in the land to try the nation of Israel. And there's no conflict between the two. It's the divine point of view on the one hand, the human point of view on the other hand. And this is the Almighty using the occasion of Samson's weakness, in which the Philistines will suffer immensely at his hands, and he will begin to deliver the nation of Israel. Samson went down with his father and his mother to Timnah, and he came to the vineyards of Timnah. And behold, a young lion roared against him. In the Hebrew, there's a number of words for roar. This word means a full-grown cub, as you can see from looking up in the concordance. In other words, you've got a full-grown cub at its great period of strength, and it roars against Samson. And the Spirit of the Lord came mightily upon him, and he tore the lion asunder as one tears a kid. And he had nothing in his hand. Again, notice the thing in the period of the Judges. It's not that Samson was fully equipped, ready to take on a lion. He didn't have a spear or a javelin. It's a period when God is delivering, not by the strength of man, but his strength is being made perfect in human weakness. And there he is, unequipped to handle a lion. And it's the Almighty who intervenes. And the Spirit of the Lord came mightily upon him, and he tore the lion asunder as one tears a kid. And the emphasis, he had nothing in his hand. Here he was bereft, humanly speaking, of any means of defense at all. And yet God came to his rescue. But he did not tell his father or his mother what he had done. And then he went down and talked with the woman, and she pleased Samson well. And you can see sin. King Sin, the crouching lion, waiting for the person at the door. And here Samson is, and he has the small compromises with the nation. The nation compromised divine instruction. And look at Samson. It's almost as if he's the epitome of what's going on in the whole nation. Every man was doing what was right in his own eyes in the nation. And there was Samson and this Philistine woman. It was right in his own eyes. She pleased him well. And on went this man, determined to secure this Philistine woman. And after a while, he returned to take her. And he turned aside to see the carcass of the lion. And behold, there was a swarm of bees in the body of the lion honey. And he scraped it into his hands and went on eating as he went. He came to his father and mother and gave some of them to eat. But he did not tell them that he had taken the honey from the carcass of the lion. Now, brothers and sisters, let's have a look for a few minutes. This is such an arresting account that there must be more to this narrative than just the record of Samson telling a lie. Now think of it. How often have you ever found bees making honeycomb in a carcass? We find bees build honeycomb in trees, in old deserted houses, in all sorts of places. But never where there's putrefaction taking place. In other words, there was something arresting in itself in bees that would make comb in the carcass of an animal. And we read here how Samson, he went back to look at the lion. There was something about this lion that arrested his attention and went back to look at the carcass of the lion. And in Hebrew, that's the word that means the fallen one. It's a peculiar word that's used here, and it means the carcass or the fallen one. And it was as if God was giving a parable to Samson in the very life experiences that he was going through, trying to arrest this man as he went bent on getting for himself a Philistine woman. The lion in Scripture, and there are many examples of this, as you well know, the lion in Scripture represented the peoples of a land. And there were just so many passages in Scripture where the great powers of the day were compared to lions. For example, the Babylonian lion in chapter 2 of verse 14 of the book of Jeremiah. And I'll read this for you. Is Israel a slave? Is he a home-born servant? Why then has he become a prey? The lions have roared against him. They have roared loudly, and they have made his land a waste. His cities are in ruins without inhabitants. Or Jeremiah 50, verse 2. These many references in the prophets to the lion-like powers of the day. And so Samson is being taught through the parable that he is to destroy a lion. How is the lion to be destroyed? Is it to be destroyed by the amassing of chariots? Or by multiplying a huge army as King Uzziah and Jehoshaphat and other kings did? Is this how the nation of Israel was to be delivered from the oppressors like the Philistines? The lesson was surely that the land was a land of milk and honey that God would give them. It was by divine strength, not by the effort of man, that the land would be conquered. And here's Samson going down to Timnah. And look at the emphasis on Timnah, the place of vineyards, representing the bounty of the land. It was the choicest grapes of the whole of the country. And he's going down to this choice place of vineyards, not to deliver the Israelites from Philistine oppression as he ought to have been. He's down there looking for a wife among the daughters of the Philistines. Like many of our young people today. He chose Philistine country, brothers and sisters, and as we shall see, he will get Philistine consequences because of the immutable law of the Almighty. As you sow, so shall you reap. But in the midst of all of this panoramic view of the history of the judges, God is working on one person, Samson. And in his life, as he goes down to Timnah, God in this parable of the lion is reminding him, Samson, there's a lion out there. Personally, it may be sin, but at this time it was the Philistine, the oppressive power of the land. And Samson was to destroy that Philistine. That was his purpose. He was to deliver Israel, not to go down to Timnah for a Philistine woman. And as a lion roared above him, this full-grown cub in the strength of his youth, well, Samson just tore him apart like a kid. And that's what Samson was to do to the Philistine power of the day. Not by his strength, but by the power that God had given him. And if he did this, if this lion was exterminated by Israel's God, as God had said, then wouldn't God provide the nourishment for the people of the land? Why, not only honey for Samson, but even for his father and mother and for the other Israelites. The land would bring forth milk and honey, as God had promised. There was no need, brothers and sisters, for the spies to go out and spy out the land. God told them what the land was like. All they had to do was to go up and take it. So here's Samson, and it's a great lesson here, brothers and sisters, of the way in which God was not only concerned for the nation as such, he was concerned for one man, Samson, to redirect this man to the attention of his life purpose, a Nazarite separated to begin to deliver the nation from bondage. And yet you see the power of sin in a person's life. When you make the first initial compromise, there may well be a twinge of conscience. But sin unchecked supplies, so to speak, its own anesthetic until the conscience becomes seared. And here's a man against the express nature of his birth, against the instruction of his dad and his mom. And he's insistent he's going down to Timnah to get a Philistine woman. And we see what happens. In verse 10, his father went down. It must have been a very sorrowful trip for him after having such a lofty introduction from the person whose name was wonderful, the angel, in setting forth the consecrated way in which Manoah's wife was to have a child, and then to find him going down to Philistine country to get a wife. And Samson made a feast there. And the word for a feast has the idea of a drinking feast, not just a feast where you eat. The Hebrew has the idea of a drinking feast, being a violation of the Nazarite vow. When the people saw him, they brought 30 companions to be with him. In other words, when they saw what sort of man he was, they brought 30 companions to be with him. And Samson said to them, "Let me now put a riddle to you. If you can tell me what it is within the 7 days of the feast and find it out, I will give you 30 linen garments and 30 festal garments." Now, these must have been worth some money. It was obviously very costly because it would impoverish the Philistines to begin with if they had to take and pay out. So they were very concerned about it. And of course, he used the very divine parable that God had given to him, and he uses it as a riddle for these Philistines. Out of the ear came something to eat. Out of the strong came something sweet. And they could not in 3 days tell what the riddle was. And so the little Philistine girl that he was so anxious to get began to work on him like a piece of putty. Verse 16. Samson's wife wept before him and said, "You only hate me. You do not love me. You have put a riddle to my countrymen, and you have not told me what it is." And he said to her, "Behold, I have not told my father nor my mother, and shall I tell you?" And she wept before him the 7 days of their feast. And on the seventh day he told her, because she pressed him hard. Like the dripping of water on a rock, Samson was eroded. Of course, he told her what the riddle was. And the end was not very pleasant for Samson, and not very pleasant for the Philistines either. Because you can see from this little outline of the history of the life of Samson, he went down to Ashkelon, as you see here in verse 19, and he killed 30 men of the town, presumably nobles or very wealthy people, and he took their spoil or their armor, and gave the festal garments to those who had told the riddle. And in hot anger, he went back to his father's house, and look what happened. And Samson's wife, who was given to his companion, or to his best friend. And so there you see a man bent on sin. He couldn't be retrieved from his dad and mom's point of view. God had worked, so to speak, an enacted parable in what was going on in his life, and Samson wasn't even arrested by this. Yet as he sowed, he reaped. God used the occasion to punish the Philistines. 30, no doubt, of the picked men of the city of Ashkelon fell at the hands of Samson. And the very thing that he sought so much eluded his grasp, and the indignity of his wife being given to his best man. Chapter 15, verse 1. After a while, Samson went down to visit his wife with a kid. And he said, I'll go down to my wife in the chamber. He still hasn't learned his lesson. But her father would not allow him to go in. And her father said, I really thought you ought to be hating her, so I gave her to your companion. Is not her younger sister fairer than she? Take her instead. Now, needless to say, this didn't please Samson very well. So then he went and he took the foxes, and he put torches between their tails, and he set all the standing grain on fire of the Philistines, burned up the shocks and the standing grain, as well as the orchards. And of course the Philistines came looking for Samson. And when they heard what had been done, they said, Samson, the son-in-law of the Timnite, because he has taken his wife and given her to his companion. And the Philistines came up and burned her and her father with fire. So you can see the tragic end of the first episode of Samson, who began to deliver Israel as a Nazarite. And the first problem he had was with the woman of Timnah. He never did take her to be his wife. She was given to his best man. And look what happened to her. Both her and her father's house were burned with fire. So that was the first major lesson in the life of Samson. And we see here in the first account how the Philistines, their oppression was beginning to be broken by this man who may deem to be so great that when they saw what sort of man he was, they brought 30 companions to be with him, and how he destroyed 30 men of the city of Ashkelon. And now, brothers and sisters, we're introduced to the compromising period of the life of Samson. Samson went down and smote the Philistines, hip and thigh, we're told here, and he went down and stayed at the cliff of the rock of Etam, where the wild beasts were. The Philistines came up in verse 9 and encamped in Judah and made a raid on Lehi. And the men of Judah said, why have you come up against us? And they said, we have come up to bind Samson and to do to him as he did to us. Then 3,000 men of Judah went down to the cleft of the rock of Etam and said to Samson, do you not know that the Philistines are rulers over us? What then is this that you have done to us? And he said to them, as they did to me, so have I done to them. And they said to him, we have come down to bind you, that we may give you into the hand of the Philistines. What a tragic state of affairs in the nation of Israel when every man did what was right in his own eyes. Peaceful coexistence. 3,000 men of Judah come down to take one man. Don't you know that the Philistines are rulers over us? Now, could you believe, brothers and sisters, that the very ecclesia of God could have stooped so low as to take the one man that God was working through in the whole of the nation to begin to deliver him, to deliver them, and they want to come down and find him? So we see that in the ecclesia of God, brothers and sisters, you know, sometimes we may have beautiful Christadelphian halls. We may have carpeting to make it easier to walk in the hall. We may have air conditioning to make it nicer to bear the heat in the summertime. We may have beautiful pews to sit on in the Christadelphian hall. But if we've got no fire in our bones for the truth, what good is it? What kind of fire did these men of Judah, lion-like Judah, with the great heritage they had, and they come down. Don't you know the Philistines are rulers over us? And what are you doing, stirring up this trouble with the Philistines? We're going to take you, Samson, and bind you. And we can see that great degeneration that began by compromising with the Canaanites, the Perizzites, and the Amorites in the land, until finally we have this tragic case here with the one man that God's working through the nation to deliver him, and the men of Judah want to take him and bind him with ropes. Let us always beware, brothers and sisters, in our life in the truth, that we don't become like these empty men of Judah, with no fire of truth in their bones, no zeal to stand for what's right, and that a peaceful coexistence at any price was all the men of Judah wanted. Just leave me alone and let me live. And Samson said to them, swear to me that you will not fall down upon me yourselves. And they said, no, we'll only bind you, Samson, and give you into their hands. They're very nice friends. So they bound him with new ropes and brought him from the rock. Then he came to Lehi, and Philistines came shouting out to meet him. A great triumph for them. The men of Judah have delivered into their hands. It's a great conquest. And the Spirit of the Lord came mightily upon him. And the ropes which were on his arms became as flax as hot fire. And his bonds melted off his hands. He found a fresh jawbone of an ass and put out with his hand and seized it. And he slew 1,000 men. And there you see Samson by divine power. And how did he do it? With an insignificant thing like the jawbone of an ass. Divine strength made perfect in human weakness. But where there was a will to work, God was able to use this, albeit imperfect, vessel Samson. And he went out and he slew 1,000 of the Philistines. And then Samson is brought again to the point of relying on divine power. Because at the end of his great victory, he was very thirsty, verse 18. And he called on the Lord and said, thou hast granted this great deliverance by the hand of thy servant. And now I shall die of thirst and fall into the hands of the uncircumcised. And so we see God bringing Samson again to the point where he has to rely on divine strength and perfect weakness. Time and time in this terrible period of judges, we find this lesson being brought home. And God did deliver him, and God brought forth water. Now, when we see all of this as history in the life of Samson, we expect to find a very chaste Samson, a man walking more discreetly in his work as a judge in Israel, a man walking more in keeping with his high calling. But what do we find? We find rather, brothers and sisters, a man who debases the truth in what he does. We've seen what happened with the woman of Timnah. He never did take the woman that was right in his own eyes, and she was burned at the hand of the Philistines. And now we read in verse 1 of chapter 16, Samson went to Gaza. And there he saw a harlot, and he went unto her. And the Gazites were told, Samson has come here. And they surrounded the place and lay in wait for him all night at the gate of the city. And he kept quiet all night, saying, let us wait till the light of the morning, and then we will kill him. But Samson lay until midnight, and at midnight he arose and took hold of the doors of the gate of the city and the two posts, and pulled them up, bar and all, and put them on his shoulders, and carried them to the top of the hill that is before Hebron. Brothers and sisters, this is extremely interesting in the account. Samson has gone to Gaza, the place that meant the strong place. And he went down there not to deliver the nation of Israel from Philistine oppression. He didn't go down to smash this strong place of the Philistines, this place of the uncircumcised Philistine. He went down there to seek his own pleasure. He went down there and debased the cause of the truth with the Philistines. And he left, brothers and sisters, absolutely unscathed, so it seemed. And at midnight he went and with great impunity, he just used the power of God and tore up the gates, the bars, and took them up to the top of Hebron and left them there. And you can imagine the nation of Israel, how the men of Judah, when they heard what this man had done, as word of mouth would pass from hamlet to hamlet, how he'd taken the very gates and the bars of the city and walked uphill with them and left them on the top of the hill. It would appear to be a great source of humor and a great source of victory
at the expense of the Philistines. Now, the narrative appears to stop there as far as Gaza is concerned, but it doesn't. Because Samson, with this sin unchecked, these women who were right in his own eyes, the sin was to find him out. And after this, he loved a woman in the valley of Sorek, the valley of the vineyards, whose name was Delilah, the languisher. We don't know for sure that she's a Philistine woman, but it seems like she is. And the lords of the Philistines came to her and said to her, "Entice him and see wherein his great strength lies." Now, in part, this picture depicts what Samson must have been like. If he could carry the bars and the gates of the city, then he certainly was not likely a diminutive man. He was probably a fairly large man. But he was not so muscular that it appeared that his strength all rested in his muscles, because the Philistines were unable to find out wherein lay his great strength. And of course, it did not rest in his muscles, because when the power of God was removed from him, he was weak like any other man. So let us not think that Samson was like Goliath, some 9 feet tall. And so Delilah began to work on him. "Please tell me wherein your great strength lies," she said, "and how you might be bound that one could subdue you." Samson said to her, "Let them bind me with 7 fresh bowstrings," which didn't work, because he snapped the bowstrings as a string of tow would snap when it touches the fire. And so the secret of his strength was not known. And Delilah said to Samson, "Will you only mock me? Please tell me how you might be bound." He said, "Well, just use new ropes that have never been used before, and I'll be bound like any other man." He snapped the ropes off his arms like a thread. And then he begins to get close. And he said to her, "If you weave the 7 locks of my head with the web and make it tight with the pin, then I shall become weak like any other man." So you see how he's becoming closer and closer to what the secret of his strength is all about. And finally, Delilah says to him, "How can you say, 'I love you'?" Samson should have heard that before. "When your heart is not with me, you have mocked me these 3 times, and you have not told me wherein your great strength lies." And when she pressed him hard with her words day after day and urged him, his soul was vexed or grieved unto death. And he told her all that was in his mind. And he said to her, "A razor has never come upon my head, for I have been a Nazarite to God from my mother's womb. And if I be shaved, then my strength will leave me, and I shall become weak like any other man." And what happens, brothers and sisters, is history. He told her all that was in his mind. And we leave now this strong man, Samson, who left the city after being with a harlot, a Philistine harlot. And we come to this picture. We come to a man who was to begin to deliver the nation from Philistine oppression. What is he going to do? He's going to feed Philistine mouths. We're going to find a man here that lusted after Philistine women with a pair of eyes that he could never really control. They were always right in his own eyes. What happened to him? And the Philistines seized him, and they gouged out his eyes, and brought him down to Gaza, and bound him with bronze fetters, and he ground at the mill in the prison. And what a tragic story of a man with such a lofty call. Great privilege, great blessings, but a weakness, brothers and sisters, that this man never came to grips with until this period in his life. And you can imagine how Samson felt as he surveyed his life with his eyes gouged out, those very eyes that he saw the woman of Timnah. He did what was right in his own eyes. And where did they take him, brothers and sisters? Where did Samson go? He went back to Gaza to take in grind grain in the Philistine grist mill. And you can imagine as Samson labored there doing the work of women and asses, because because that's what did the work in the Philistine grist mills. And how the weed seeds and how the dust of the grain on his sweaty muscles would itch and annoy him as he worked on there laboring to grind food to feed Philistine mouths. Wouldn't he know the truth of the proverb? Better is he that rules his spirit than he who takes a city. And a man without self-control is like a city broken into and left without walls. When you see Samson, brothers and sisters, you see a Christadelphian young person. A nice, handsome Christadelphian boy, perhaps, who can net Christadelphian dates as well as Philistine ones. There's the tragic end of the man Samson. Brothers and sisters, we may have great blessings and great privilege, but let us not presume upon these any more than Samson. God's strength is made perfect in human weakness. When we rely on our own strength, brothers and sisters, and when we go our own way, despite everything that God has to tell us in His Word, then we see the tragic consequences which follow. But true to the pattern of the judges, where we have sin, suffering, supplication, and deliverance, so we see the man. We see the man doing what was right in his own eyes, as it appeared to the judges. We see his sin. Then we see his supplication. Because the Philistines convened a great feast in verse 23 to Dagon, their God. Our God has given Samson, our enemy, into our hand, they said. And when the people saw him, they praised their God, for they said, our God has given our enemy into our hand, the ravager of our country, who has slain many of us. And this was the great Philistine mistake. It was the mistake that the Philistines made when they took on the nation of Israel and when David rose to the fore. It was not a battle then between merely the Philistines and the Israelites. It was Dagon versus the chariots of the Almighty, the heavenly chariots of the Almighty. And God stopped it in this moment of supplication on the part of Samson to bring great victory. And Samson called the Lord in verse 28 and said, O Lord God, remember me, I pray thee, and strengthen me, I pray thee, only this once, O God, that I may be avenged upon the Philistines for one of my two eyes. And Samson grasped the two pillars upon which the house rested, and he leaned his weight upon them, and his right hand on the one, and his left hand on the other, and said, let me die with the Philistines. And so this man died, who began to deliver Israel, and he began to deliver Israel by killing and destroying more Philistines in his death than he had in all of his life. So, brothers and sisters, this man, Samson, who likely have preserved for us in the period of the judges, is a man for us who obtained promises, as we can see. He stopped the mouths of lions, as the record in Hebrews says. He escaped the edge of the sword, as we read here. He was a man who won strength over weakness, who in a trial of mockings and bonds of imprisonment was tormented and afflicted. And so in God's divine honor roll in the book of Hebrews, we find the man Samson there. What does Samson teach us? Brothers and sisters, Samson teaches us that we should renounce irreligion and worldly passion, and live sober, upright, and godly lives in this world, that we might flee immorality and pursue righteousness.